Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Hannah Rosen, a senior editor at The Atlantic and founder of XX Slate's Women's Section. She has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, GQ, The New Republic, and The Washington Post, and is the recipient of the 2010 National Magazine Award. Her latest book just out is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hannah Rosen.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And so we're experiencing the twilight of the patriarchy, I understand. And I'm wondering whether Rick Santorum, Paul Ryan, and Mitt Romney know about it.
They probably don't know about it. That's a really good point. And I also like your poetic phrase. That would have made a better book title, perhaps.
Well, it's interesting, though, isn't it, to compare those three gentlemen with the current incumbent in the White House and the last Democrat, both of whom came out of a matriarchal situation largely, didn't they, in terms of their childhood?
Yes, that's a very good point. And actually, when I was listening to their visions of family at the two conventions, you really did see a completely different picture. So in Ann Romney's speech, for example, she gave a vision of a very traditional family life, even though a lot of Republican voters, in fact, are not that person. I mean, a lot of red state voters are in a situation where they're less likely to get married, more likely to have children alone. And so, but yet the appeal they make is a very traditional appeal.
And your book, The End of Women and the End of Men and the Rise of Women, Hannah Rosen, focuses on the United States and on how much the new service economy has brought about this new phenomenon. One of the most, I think, clear statistics that support your argument is that the average wife today contributes some 42.2% of the family income, up sharply from the 2 to 6% that women contributed in the 1970s. That's a pretty profound change.
Yes, I mean, one amazing thing about reporting the book, which grew out of a magazine story, is I started out thinking about this as a largely economic phenomenon, you know, having to do with changes in the economy, moving towards a service and information economy. But in the couple of years since I've been researching it, I realized how deeply it seeped into so much of how we live now, about, you know, decisions we make about marriage, about raising our children, about dating lives, you know, even our violence patterns. I mean, it really has changed a lot of American life and life in other countries, although it manifests itself differently in different countries. I have a chapter on Korea in the book, for example, which is an extremely patriarchal society, but has all this sort of budding, you know, women are moving so quickly in that society, it's really shaking things up.
Well, we actually started out talking about China and the idea that China and Japan, the world's second and third largest economies, could go to war over some desolate islands. China, of course, has always favored the male child, and I guess that goes back to Confucianism.
Yes. I mean, the Asian societies, I mean, China's a different case because it has a one-child policy, and actually the Asian societies are very erratic on this question. So in some, you see sort of heavy favoritism towards the male child. And then you have these great statistics being kept on Korea, which is the country I focus on, in which that preference has now shifted so that families are saying they'd rather have a girl. And that's only shifted in the last decade or so.
Well, what made me think about China and favoring the male child is the notion that the growing hegemon in the world today is going to be run by a bunch of spoiled brats.
Are you talking about the Chinese?
The Chinese princelings were grown up. They brought up in a culture where they were worshipped.
Right.
Could do no wrong.
Right. No, that is a very good point. That's a whole other dynamic. Yeah. The worship of the firstborn. You know, the Chinese son.
But let's continue on though on the United States here, because in terms of the end of men and the rise of women. The point being is that this has largely happened because of a social collapse resulting from the evisceration of the manufacturing base and putting so many men out of work.
That's where it starts. I mean, you see that, you know, it used to be perfectly possible to have a prosperous middle-class life if you worked in a manufacturing industry. And I have one of my chapters was reported entirely in a manufacturing town in Alabama in which people were living quite good lives with, you know, a little bit of education and a little engineering degree. And suddenly you see that doesn't, you can't do that anymore. I mean, that doesn't work as a way of entering the middle class. And so a lot of those men effectively got left behind in the new era. We haven't quite figured out what the post-manufacturing era is, and men are having a harder time adapting, basically, while women are having an easier time. So that basically means going to college, getting the credentials and degrees you need in order to meet whatever the economy throws your way.
Well, just a statistic here that since 2000, the manufacturing economy has lost 6 million jobs, a third of its total workforce, most of it male. And in 1950, 1 in 20 men in their prime were not working. Today, the number is a terrifying 1 in 5.
Yes, I mean, a lot of economists describe that as, you know, the great social catastrophe, because as you can imagine, it has a lot of social ramifications, which is basically that, you know, men then sort of drop out of civil society. We've seen it happen before in American culture, and they don't live with their families. They're not necessarily supporting their families. They kind of lose a sense of purpose and leadership, and that's not really good for anybody.
Again, I'm speaking with Hannah Rosen, a senior editor at The Atlantic and founder of XX, Slate's Women's Sections. She's the author of the new book just out, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. So let's talk about the new matriarchy and particularly the poor and middle class manifestation of it. And obviously, I don't know that there is a 1% matriarchy. I know... Ann Romney did her best to try and portray herself as being an ordinary housewife, but just to concentrate on, particularly on the poor, the notion that we have so many women that are working and having jobs and raising children alone without the male, and in a sense, if the man can't pull his weight, he's just another mouth to feed.
Yes, that's a phrase that's extremely insulting, and yet one that I heard over and over again from women. I mean, one of the images that stuck with me from reporting the book is this image of a woman in a community college who falls asleep between the first floor and the eighth floor because, like many women in community college, she's raising children, she's holding a job, she's getting an education so she can get a slightly better job. An MIT economist called it the last one holding the bag theory, meaning the woman is the last one holding the bag, that she's not necessarily working because she wants to or because she's on a great feminist crusade. She's working because somebody has to do it. I mean, that somebody has to feed the children. So everywhere I go across the country, you see this dynamic taking hold and destabilizing. We recently passed the 50% of children born to mothers under 30 are born to single mothers. That is, you know, or unmarried mothers rather, and that's because of this phenomenon I described, because the women are essentially choosing not to marry the men and instead to go it alone.
Well, I have a millennial daughter who's in medical school, and most of her class, certainly the majority of her class, are women. And I believe that's true as well in law schools, although I'm not sure we need any more lawyers. But tell me about hookup culture with today's young women, because it's always been, you know, the man has always been portrayed in popular culture and literature as the protagonist in romance,
yes.
Not to mention sex.
Yes. Well, your daughter could probably help us on this one, but I have a slightly different take on it. It's perhaps my most controversial chapter, which is that women are almost always portrayed exclusively as victims in this new culture. And for those who don't know what it is, it's essentially a way of having intimate relationships without a long-term commitment. So hookup is the shorthand we use for that. And often we say, you know, that's the man's world, that's the ultimate male fantasy, isn't that what all men want? And thanks to these researchers who I talked to, had spent 4 years in this college camped out in the storm, what they found was that, in fact, women were avoiding getting into long-term relationships, that at that moment in their lives, they were very much focused on their careers and establishing themselves, and so the hookup culture essentially allowed them to have some kind of emotional intimacy, and we're not talking about one-night stands, but we are talking about ways to have relationships without necessarily being completely tied down. And I have to say, of all the parts of my books, that's the most I've heard from young women, is them basically writing me letters and telling me, look, we have invented these new forms of things. You know, it's not that we love one-night stands or we don't have a lot of complaints about the hookup culture, but we are inventing these new things that are somewhere between headed towards marriage and one-night stands.
So it's not necessarily that that these women have hearts of steel.
Yeah, I mean, in the chapter, I basically follow one girl throughout, and she starts out in kind of everybody's caricature of a girl in the hookup culture, which we've actually seen in movies these days. There's a movie, Bachelorette, which came out this month, and, you know, trash-talking, like, vulgar, like, you know, the kind of women who you listen to her talk and you think, oh, my gosh. But then by the end of the chapter, you watch her move through the culture until she's getting engaged. So you see that, you know, like most American women, this is the phase that they go through. College-educated women are still extremely likely to get married eventually, and so this is the phase they seem to go through in their 20s and 30s.
So she ends up remembering his name in the morning.
Exactly, and marrying him.
Oh my God.
For sure.
Tell me, Anna Rosen, about successful women. I mentioned a lot of the book focuses on the new emerging matriarchy in poor and middle class America, but you do have examples of successful women in the Silicon Valley.
Yes, that's a different set of, you know, one thing when people ask, they read the title of the book and they say, oh, what about leadership? You know, why don't we see more women in leadership, which is a perfectly, completely valid question. And so I try and workshop kind of what happens at the top and what prevents women from getting through. And the reason I chose Silicon Valley for the book is because that's the one that economists say has figured out a slightly new way for women to be ambitious and still be present in their families. And it largely has to do with flexibility and the idea that they don't have any preconceived notions of how a workplace has to be, unlike, say, Wall Street or law firms, you know, who count by the hour. Silicon Valley allows women to come up with these fairly creative arrangements. So they work like mad. I mean, they're working all day and all night. They're working all the time. It's not necessarily the life anyone would choose, but it does allow them to keep a foot in both worlds and makes them quite happy. So I just use them as a model for the emerging creative American marketplace as we would like it to be if we truly want to succeed.
So it's not exactly commonplace. The example where Google a woman at Google persuaded her boss to fly her child and her nanny with her around the world on business class.
I know. I thought that was amazing. She told me that she basically presented them the spreadsheet of exactly how much it would cost them to hire a new employee and train a new employee to do her job. She'd been quite good at it, and she'd been doing it for a number of years, and then presented, you know, and then compared that to how much it would cost to fly her nanny and child, you know, to all of her international destinations, and she was right. It was cheaper to fly her nanny and child, so that's what they did. You can't imagine that happening in too many workplaces, just as you can't imagine when Marissa Mayer of Google became the CEO of Yahoo. You can't quite imagine, you know, and she was visibly pregnant when she was chosen as CEO and said that she wasn't going to take any maternity leave. Now, that's not really a viable model for most women. Most women want to take some form of maternity leave, but on the other hand, I'm happy that new models like that exist, that we can see such a thing. We can wonder what her husband's going to do or help out with the baby, and, you know, that they exist for women to look up to, even if they don't want to exactly do that themselves.
So, Anna Rosen, the book also deals with women in the military, in as much as women now as warriors, even though ostensibly they haven't been given combat roles, but in this new form of warfare, the lines are very blurred, and we know that women have actually been in combat.
Right.
It's interesting, you know, a few years ago I went to Denmark to do some research on a screenplay I was writing about Niels Bohr, the nuclear scientist in Denmark, Nazi-occupied Denmark during the war, who the Allies desperately wanted to get out because of his knowledge about atomic physics. And he ended up getting to Los Alamos and working on the first atomic bomb. And he was spirited out of the country by the Danish underground at the time when they got all of the Danish Jews out to Sweden. Uh-huh. So I met with a lot of Danish underground people who'd been involved with Niels Bohr and in the war, and they, without exception, they all told me that in the underground the most deadly people of all were the women. They were the best assassins. I was absolutely blown away.
That's so interesting. I have a section in there about violence, of course, in the book, because I was flabbergasted myself when you look at the numbers of how much more and different kinds of female violence there is these days. And one of my asides in that chapter is about female suicide bombers. And we have always, you know, conjectured that the reason there are more women suicide bombers, we sort of attribute all these emotional stories to them, and maybe their husband was killed. But it turns out they're just a lot more lethal. They're better at it. They hide things better.
Right. You know, I'm sorry to stop you here, Anna, but we're out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I mean, speak with Hannah Rosen, the senior editor of The Atlantic and founder of XX, Slate's women's section. She's the author of a new book just out, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.